Welcome everyone to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are on paper 39, section 4, which is old single column, page 343. 434. 434. I said 343, didn't I? That's pretty hilarious. 434. Some kind of weird dyslexia there. It's kind of a reciprocal or something. Okay, yeah. So, single column, page 434. It's too many fours with the section four. All right. So let's remember how we're in the midst of going through the different primary groups of seraphim. If you can't remember them off the top of your head, just flip back and remind yourself. We did group one, the supreme seraphim, and then group two, the superior seraphim, group three, the supervisor seraphim. And certainly with those three designations, it all sounds like they're in the upper phases of working with the local universe. And they were. So then we drop down another notch. And now it's just a kind of a very straightforward designation of administrator seraphim. And we saw that, a lot of what, these various seraphim are doing, you could say in a very general way, is about assisting with the administration of the local universe. So, with that recognition in mind, when you see that there's a group that's just designated administrator seraphim, this is probably where the rubber is starting to meet the road. In terms of this whole effort. And it is, as we'll see when we get into it. This is, these are the seraphim that are working with the most initial phases of the mortals in the local universe. Getting them going on the initial mortal world, working with them through the mansion worlds and up to the system capital. So this is the real bedrock, the foundational aspect of all these seraphim, doing that overarching, helping with the administration phenomenon. Okay, so let's just get into it, and we'll, as we get into the subgroups again, remember how each of these has seven subgroups. As we get into the subgroups again, we'll remind ourselves of the patterns that we've been seeing, in the subgroups, a particular numbered subgroup as you go from group to group. All right.
Number four, administrative seraphim. The fourth order of seraphim are assigned to the administrative duties of the local systems. They're indigenous to the system capitals, but are stationed in large numbers on the mansion and Marantia spheres, and on the inhabited worlds. Fourth order seraphim are by nature endowed with unusual administrative ability. They are the able assistants of the directors of the lower divisions of the universe government of a creator sun, and are mainly occupied with the affairs of the local systems and their component worlds. They are organized for service as follows.
Okay, so it's all pretty much just like we were saying there. But let me just remind you again, with a name like Administrator Seraphim, and and starting right out with the fourth order of Seraphim are assigned to the administrative duties. You're definitely going to want to be challenging yourself with such labels. Because from a, animal origin, not very developed world perspective like we have, the word administrative or administrator, you know, doesn't sound very high, angelic, you know, whatever you want to say. Yeah. You know, remember, remind yourself again what we saw just recently as we were going through this. By and large, what these seraphim are doing, high and low, is beyond our understanding. I mean, they're all of the seraphim, even when they're getting down to the lower levels, quote unquote, as we're getting to here, are still doing things that are very of a very high order relative to anything that we can currently imagine. So the challenge is to try to imagine how administration could be something less boilerplate, less bureaucratic, you know, or whatever kind of negative, you know, concept, you know, that name invokes, that word invokes for you, you know, to challenge yourself to not think of it in such diminished ways. We are going to relish in all kinds of levels of administrative activity from here to eternity. And, you know, we all know how many times the revelators kind of speak like that. And so it's a general challenge to let that be undiscovered country in your mind, you know, that concept. How incredibly satisfying, exciting such a fact is that English really only can describe as administration. There's just no other word that, you know, is appropriate to tempt to direct us in that, you know, to where this activity is. But, you know, I mean, if nothing else, you know, you can remind yourself, like people, you know, sometimes do, and they want to think about it a little bit fancier sense. I mean, to administer is to minister. You know, it just means that, you know, the AD prefix just means it's more definitively to. Not just minister in a more unity-like sense, but administer to. So there's a definitive amount of individuality involved in, you know, in that word. That you're bringing the unity to a focus point where it's really helping an individual become part of the cosmic system. You know, the cosmic system is sort of to the back of you, and you're as an administrator, and you're bringing that through your wisdom and then using your fingers to delicately engage individuals in a precise way.
You made me think of Andrew with the apostles. Wasn't he the administrative chief of the apostles?
Yeah.
And he was the most well-balanced, they say, right in the beginning of the character traits. I mean, the guy may have been, you know, hitting the seventh adjutant an awful lot. You know?
Right. So that, to, you know, just that, see that recognition of that relationship to the apostle Andrew. You know, to be a very good administrator is to have a lot of wisdom. And that's something that is an interesting aspect of what we're about to get into. You know, remember that, you know, especially if this is an administrator seraphim that was just created at that level, they have a lot of direct technical ability to do these details that we aren't really able to comprehend exactly what exactly they're doing. But they can do those, you know, they can do those details very well, but that experiential wisdom, especially with a lot of vertical depth to it, is not necessarily there. You know, and so they might be a little fragile if a rebellion comes along. You know, they might not quite have the integrity. You know. But if we get up to these kinds of levels of administrative ability, you know, we should have a lot more wisdom under our belt, have a lot more integrity, plus, you know, that skill. Okay, so let's look at the first subgroup here.
Number one, administrative assistants. These able seraphim are the immediate assistants of a system sovereign, a primary Lunanodex son. They are invaluable aids in the execution of the intricate details of the executive work of the system headquarters. They also serve as the personal agents of the system rulers. Journeying back and forth in large numbers to the various transition worlds and to the inhabited planets, executing many commissions for the welfare of the system and in the physical and biologic interests of its inhabited worlds.
Okay, so it's even more focused. You not only have Administrator Seraphim, but you have the administrative assistants is this subgroup number one. And recall what we've discovered about in the other groups about this subgroup number one. It is fundamentally the group, you know, they're working with the suns, the universe suns, and they're working with the executive actions, the administrative actions. So, you know, this is really where, all of this administrative aspect, you know, that's woven through all of this really comes to a sharp point, is in these seraphim. And they're working with, you know, they're about to mention the planetary princes, and they're working with both the system sovereigns and the planetary princes. Let's see, anything else in there that I want to bring out? That last little bit. Notice that, remember how we were expecting things to be moving to the individuality mode with this group of seraphim. As we looked at the previous two groups, we had some unity things that we were picking up, you know, two groups back, and then the previous, you know, immediately preceding group, we had a lot of associativity, and so we were expecting this to have the individuality element. And you notice how that first paragraph ends there. Executing many commissions for the welfare of the system and in the physical and biologic interests of its inhabited worlds. So, you know, in a very literal sense, the substance that expresses individuality, matter, and physical matters are issues are in play. So it's very much a rubber meets the road. See. Sort of ministry, and then we just have to try to imagine exactly what the spirit things that they're doing, what implications those have so immediately to physical and biologic interests. I mean, that's mysterious. You know, we can't understand that, but nonetheless, it is very much, see, getting down to where we are and what we're up to. That's the point here.
These same seraphic administrators are also attached to the governments of the world rulers, the planetary princes. The majority of planets in a given universe are under the jurisdiction of a secondary Lunatic sun, but on certain worlds, such as Urantia, there has been a miscarriage of the divine plan. In the event of the defection of a planetary prince, these seraphim become attached to the Melchizedek receivers and their successors in planetary authority. The present acting ruler of Urantia is assisted by a corps of 1,000 of this versatile order of seraphim.
Okay, so who is our acting ruler?
Lanaforge?
No, the acting ruler on this planet. No, I mean, it's a cycle. They come every 100 years. The resident governor general, right? The resident governor general, you know, is the individual that's, you know, basically fulfilling the substitute role for the planetary prince. I mean, not completely. You know, we all know it's very complicated. But in terms of having, you know, an administrative staff like this, it's that individual that's from one of the 24 counselors that's coming here. You know, they're rotating every 100 years as the resident governor general. Okay, so the resident governor general has a corps of 1,000 of these seraphim, and they're going to be amongst those that didn't join the rebellion. They're going to be a tested group, in a number of ways. And in that regard, they're obviously wanting us to think about that a little bit. So that whole issue of having, a rebellion, and in our case, we had both the system sovereign rebelling. So there was a bunch of administrator seraphim attached to Lucifer that would have joined the rebellion. And we had our planetary prince join the rebellion. So there was a whole bunch of administrator seraphim attached to Caligastia that joined the rebellion. And they were very large numbers. You may recall when you're reading about the rebellion that you don't have a lot of supreme, superior, or supervisor seraphim involved. But once you get to the administrator seraphim, there were large numbers that joined the rebellion. You start talking in terms of fractions, of the total number. In terms of the administrator seraphim that were assigned to the system sovereign, to Lucifer, they say that over a third of those administrator seraphim joined the rebellion. Over a third, and we're talking very large numbers.
There's only 1,000.
No. We're talking about on the system sovereign.
Oh, okay.
Okay, the system sovereign.
Just here.
How many are on Gerasim, assisting the system sovereign? It's got to be quite a few. Okay. Over a third of those joined the rebellion. So, some huge number of angels were lost there. We can, perhaps some of them didn't go all the way and, are in, waiting for the adjudication. It'll be put back into service in some, minimal way. But nonetheless, there was a lot of chaos amongst the administrator seraphim on Gerasim. And then here, with Caligastia, they tell you that almost half of the administrator and transition seraphim, another one of these lower groups of seraphim. So they lump the two together, so you don't know, how much of each. But those two lower groups, almost half. Okay, so again, it's going to be, a significant amount of loss there. All right, so. And you'll see when we get a little bit further, they talk about those issues of the fraction that are lost some more. But now, in the case of in the next group, I foreshadow this a little bit. If you flip to the next group, you notice that the planetary helpers, and those are the ones that work with the Adams and Eves. Even though they're a lower group of angels, remind yourself of, in our case, Adam and Eve came long after the rebellion. Okay, so, you don't have an issue with those angels getting caught up. So that's why, if you skip over the planetary helpers, the next one are the transition ministers. That's why they talk about the administrator and the transition ones together, that almost a half. They skipped over the planetary helpers because they were, subsequent. So that's why that was stated that way. All right. So that's, it's just a general thing that they're doing administrator stuff, and we don't really know. But certainly in this case, we see, the pattern is holding very, very solidly what we saw in subgroup number one, this whole issue about really kind of working on administrative, executive sort of issues with the suns. And here it's the Lunanodec suns. Okay, now remember what's the deal with the second subgroup as we were going through the previous groups. That was all about either mercy or justice, which are just two sides of the same fact, depending on how you're looking at it. Are you looking at it more from the unity side or the individuality side? So maybe just flipping back and reminding yourself, we had the court advisors, we had the voice of mercy, then we had the law forecasters, And so now we have the justice guides. All right, so all that's just, you know, with the name, it's just right there again. Obviously, the pattern is holding that, and it's basically about mercy and justice. All right, what do they say?
Number two, justice guides. These are the angels who present the summary of evidence concerning the eternal welfare of men and angels when such matters come up for adjudication in the tribunals of a system or a planet. They prepare the statements for all preliminary hearings involving mortal survival. Statements which are subsequently carried with the records of such cases to the higher tribunals of the universe and the superuniverse. The defense of all cases of doubtful survival is prepared by these seraphim, who have a perfect understanding of all the details of every feature of every count in the indictments drawn by the administrators of universe justice.
Okay. So, couple things that kind of jump out besides the basic facts there. Notice at the beginning concerning the welfare of men and angels. So, as we were just saying, an awful lot of administrator seraphim were involved in joining the rebellion. So, you know, you're going, well, these are administrator seraphim. How does that work? Well, keep that in mind here as we keep reading here. But, yes, initially, see, obviously, these justice guides would be involved in assessing the status of their fellow, vast numbers of their fellow administrator seraphim who joined the rebellion, and the whole initial adjudication of those issues. And then the last thing, as John was commenting, it's starting to sound a little bit like an episode of Perry Mason here or something. It's initially kind of odd. You're thinking, oh, wait a minute. I thought that, the fifth epical revelation really kind of cleared up this whole issue with survival, that there isn't some, complex, inscrutable set of rules that you're being assessed against, and you get a thumbs up or a thumbs down. It's just a matter of either you have a soul or you don't. And if you don't have a soul, you're not going to be resurrected. Isn't it pretty straightforward? So what's this about the defense of all cases of doubtful survival is prepared by these seraphim? And all this about having a perfect understanding of all the details of every feature of every count in the indictments drawn by the administrators of universe justice. Okay, it sounds like there's a whole bunch of complexity here that you're being assessed against. Okay, so let's try to make sure we aren't getting confused about that. They aren't reinvoking some complicated thing. When all comes is said and done, it's about whether or not you have a soul or not. But remember, they go through a very detailed assessment of the whole situation, because there's two sides to it. It's not all about you and whether or not you've emptied, your Marantia vessel out and it's a hollow husk now. All of the beings involved in ministering to you, especially angels, are involved in this assessment of what became of this individual who went to iniquity. Everyone has to, demonstrate that you can't say that Bob chose iniquity because his angels missed something. I mean, the angels have to testify in very precise detail, how they responded to, each time that individual sinned, and sin was compounded upon sin, all the way to iniquity, how they responded. I mean, were there any gaps in the mercy? All those issues are very minutely assessed. But when they say, that doubtful survival, why do they word it that way? I mean, the angels, remember, can see the energy, you know, a luminosity that's an energy interaction of the adjuster with your mind energy system. You know, if that luminosity goes away, they know the adjuster's left. Okay? And, you know, there's spirit death there. Now, of course, you know, you could say, well, I mean, but was there extenuating circumstances? I mean, you know, that person, you know, seemed like maybe they were go all the way to iniquity, and maybe they got there, and that's why the adjuster left. Or was there some physical things going on at the same time? You know, and maybe the brain, you know, collapsed to the point where the adjutants couldn't see it anymore, and so then the adjuster had to leave. But that individual didn't quite get to iniquity. You know, it was so close that, you know, crude observers, you know, short of the ancients of days, and the universal sensors, you know, couldn't determine whether it was precisely iniquity or not. You know, so there could be details. You know, just because the adjuster left doesn't necessarily mean, but you know, if that person was, you know, on a definitive sin track towards iniquity, you know, that's why they're saying it's doubtful, right, that it was, you know, that there's any extenuating circumstances. But anyway, see, so all of those details, and remember, it even goes to the point where even when everyone is quite certain that this is an empty soul, there's not even one little wisp of value rattling around inside of that husk anymore, they nonetheless build a complete Marantia body for it, matched to that soul, you know, that soul structure, that Marantia brain. They put that Marantia brain into that Marantia body, you know, at a resurrection moment, but the adjuster doesn't return. You know, the body doesn't animate. You know, mind doesn't seat on that brain, that Marantia brain again. And then everyone knows, see, they went through all the details. It's not like someone assumed. That's like, why waste the time building a body for this? It's not going to, you know, animate anyway. No, they never do that. So there can't be any doubt by anyone watching, you know, that there was some arbitrariness. You know, and you can imagine how much work it is to build a body, you know, for an individual that precisely matches the structure of that Marantia brain and all that, and all these things that we can't even imagine right now. They go through all of that. So, see, all of that minutia, all that detail, that's all involved in kind of the precision that seems to be, you know, and the minutia that seems to be invoked between the lines of that last statement. You know, it's a very precise affair.
Okay.
Yep.
How do these angels minister to human beings while they're here on this earth? I mean, if it's their mission to try to help the individual,
right?
You know, what are they doing?
Yeah, good question. We touched on it a little bit before. Make sure everyone on the webinar heard that, because that's a great question. You know, how exactly do these various angels minister to us? You know, we know, you know, if one was standing in front of me, I mean, I can put my hand right through that angel's body, and I mean, how, I'm very much flesh and blood. How are they going to administer to me? They can't talk to me. You know, I can't see them, can't hear them. In general, what's going on is, we may recall when we first started this, we reminded ourselves that above our mind is a spirit ministry. You know, that the upper reaches of our mind touch upon that spirit energy ministry. And that spirit ministry is a unity ministry. So that it's not like there's a region over here that's the Holy Spirit, and there's a region over here that's the Spirit of Truth. And it all is blended together in a unity ministry that our mind is reaching up and trying to synchronize with. And one of the ministries that's blended into that unity is the ministry of angels. Many, many, many different angels of all sorts of different flavors are feeding in to that spirit energy, a flavor, a character, you know, a modulation, if you want to kind of think more physically about it, you know, it's a literally spirit energy, you know, they're modulating, they're modifying, they're varying, they're, you know, coloring, you know, that energy in all kinds of different ways, that, and your mind is touching upon that, you know, and that filters down into your mind, you know. Your mind energy has a hold of that spirit energy at the top levels, and so if that spirit energy twists, your mind twists. You know, so they minister by augmenting the qualities in that spirit ministry, and so there's more, more multifaceted, more kaleidoscopic gift being given to it, the upper levels of our mind. You know, that spiritualized mind that we talk about in the upper domain of the hourglass. If you use the hourglass analogy, see the nature of that spiritualization of that mind energy, see, is colored by everything that all these different angels are doing. You know, one of them does this with that spirit energy, and that gives you a different, you know, a little different flavor in your mind energy, and another one does something else. Again, we don't know, we can't think very literally about this because we don't understand these things in a direct way.
You can experience it.
But that's what they're doing. Mm-hmm. There's just, if you took all the angels away, you know, and all you had was the Holy Spirit, the Spirit of Truth, and thought adjuster, you would, you know, if you have any higher consciousness, you would feel a change. You would feel a loss from what is there. You know, there's a whole sort of just a foothold that we have up there that we take for granted. You know, and if you saw it off one of the legs of that foothold, you would notice it. You'd suddenly be like, whoa, I feel a little, you know, vertigo or something here. This is, you know, what happened? I don't feel as balanced as I used to.
They kind of give you, I think that they kind of give you strength.
They give you a lot of things. As we start to get into some of these additional ones, especially like when we get to the planetary helpers, the next group, they're doing all kinds of things that humans have never imagined that angels were doing. Helping us in all kinds of ways to have a higher integrity, you know, that really can help you with your day-to-day life.
I think as long as you're living in the highest integrity that you can, integris that you can have, and you have faith, living faith, mm-hmm. I think that you can kind of feel them there. And if you're in some kind of a tragic situation or some mm-hmm. horrifying thing that's happening to you, you can actually reach up and you mm-hmm. can feel them. I mean, I've done that.
You feel an unmoved presence. You know, you're being moved and you'd like something solid to hold on to, and that ministry stands unmoved, you know, and it's multidimensional, so that no matter how you need to grip it to kind of get your, you know, get your bearings again, there's a grip there. All these different angels are making sure that whatever you need, if you call upon help, it's there. I need help with my moral consciousness, or I need, you know, whatever it is. Someone is ministering and augmenting that ability for you to have what you need when you need it. If you need real courage in a moment, someone is helping that to be there. You know, you're never, God has set it up so that it's never the case that if you call upon help, it's not there. You know, we just need to remember that the help that's being given is in the inner life, that genuine spiritual strength kind of help. You know, not helping you with rearranging, you know, your knickknacks on your shelf or whatever. It's not material things like humans have so tended to think about it. That's not what, you know, and so humans have always thought, well, God has abandoned me, you know, because I called upon him, you know, and he didn't smite my enemies, or he didn't give me a parking space, or whatever the heck, you know. It's like, no. I mean, the actual things that God is trying to give you, you'll never find, you know, yourself wanting. It's, you know, and 10 times more than you could ever use is just waiting for you to take a hold of it. Okay. All right. So these justice guides, see, they're definitely down there where the rubber meets the road again, and they're dealing with all of these more specific details. You know, that whole bit about and we had the law, like we read last time, and justice is applied law. So they're into all those details of exactly how the laws of the cosmos apply to this individual's circumstances. And they're the masters at that. All right.
It is not the mission of these angels to defeat or to delay justice, but rather to ensure that unerring justice is dealt out with generous mercy and fairness to all creatures. These seraphim often function on the local worlds, commonly appearing before the referee trios of the conciliating commissions, the courts for minor misunderstandings. Many who at one time served as justice guides in the lower realms later appear as voices of mercy in the higher spheres and on Salvington.
Ah, you remember that? See, if you flip back, you know, when they were talking about the superior seraphim, you know, they said that the first two subgroups, the intelligence corps and the voice of mercy, and they said that very many of the first two groups of this seraphic corps are attainment seraphim. Remember, they're coming up from the lower ranks. And so that was an example where it's not just the recorders or the transporters that have a very vertical, you know, transporters are just transporters at various levels. They're not going over and being administrator, you know, assistants or something like this. And so there's a little bit more of that in some areas. Like here, the justice guy is definitively going up in subgroup number two, you know, to the voice of mercy. And notice that little bit. Remember how we focused on that? We noticed that when they introduced that subgroup, they called it the voice of mercy, right? But look at here. Now they're speaking of individuals, and they say voices. Okay, so, you know, it is the case, just like, you know, quickeners of morality, interpreters of cosmic citizens, you know, I mean, you know, if you want to be precise, you know, they are voices of mercy, as, you know, as a set of individuals. But they very purposely, like I stressed back there, categorize that group in the singular like that, as one voice, many individuals, many seraphim, but one voice of mercy. They don't speak as conflicting voices of mercy. So they very purposely seem modified at that, because they wanted to stress that when you're dealing with that second group, the superior seraphim, remember how we noticed that it was unity level, remember, because the supervisor were associativity. And see, that unity fact was being stressed by just making it one voice. Many individuals speaking together in perfect harmony as one voice of mercy. Okay, so notice how it's not simplistic what the revelators do, how they use the language, you know. And so you could say, well, no, I think this is written in boilerplate fashion. So one of these is a mistake. You know, we need to change. We either need to make this voice of mercy here, or we need to make it voices of mercy back there. No. You know, don't think so simplistically about it like that. Appreciate why they modified that. I mean, you can tell, if you have reflective consciousness, you can reflect on it and tell if it's a typo or not, or if there's obvious truth being expressed by that. Challenge yourself to know the difference between the two, you know? And don't get into some simple-minded mode where you start erasing a differential that the revelators purposely put in there by trying to harmonize the text, you know, quote-unquote. Okay, so, you know, here it's many who, you know, and so they say voices, because they're speaking about them as individuals. They're back there, that, you know, their ministry is one. All right, let's see, what else do we have there? So you noticed how, you know, we started thinking Perry Mason at the end of the previous paragraph, and immediately they say, it is not the mission of these angels to defeat or to delay justice. It's like, oh, okay, so I shouldn't think about it so anthropomorphically.
Probably a lot of people in the webinar don't know who Perry Mason was.
Yeah, that's true.
I'm surprised you knew.
They don't think of it in terms of cliche movie or television courtroom dramas. Let's say it that way.
Favorite show of my day. I always sat down and watched it.
All right.
Or I didn't have to change to like Judge Judy. Get up to date.
No, let's not change to Judge Judy. Anyway, you see how they knew that you were, you'd be thinking that, and then, so the very next sentence, they're trying to say, no, don't think too simplistically about it. We know that the revelators went to a lot of effort to make the revelation answer, respond to your thoughts like that, so wonderfully. So that's a simple example of that. So they aren't in some sort of mode where they're trying to get you off. The ancients of days want to execute you, and you got a really great lawyer, a justice guide, and he gets you off. No, and that's not what's going on. They're just there, like they're saying, to make sure that all this precision, every I is dotted and every T is crossed. Unerring justice is dealt out with generous mercy. So at the same time that they're detailing justice, they're detailing mercy, because they're two sides of the same fact. So you just see it there again. So they're laying out all that specificity, because they're the ones down there at the real individuality detail level of the issue.
In the trenches.
Yep.
In the Lucifer Rebellion in Satania, very few of the justice guides were lost, but more than one quarter of the other administrator seraphim and of the lower orders of seraphic ministers were misled and deluded by the sophistries of unbridled personal liberty.
Okay, so see here you've got another, so in this context, where you're just talking about administrator, not just talking about administrator seraphim, but administrator seraphim and the lower orders of seraphic ministers. So lumping all those together, you get this more than one quarter figure. So they give you another little data point on that. And here you see the answer to the question that started at the beginning of the justice guides. It's like, wait a minute, isn't that going to be problematic if the justice guides are joining the rebellion and they're supposed to be the ones that are handling? No, see, very few of the justice guides were lost. So, this whole bit about they come out of their training and testing as an administrator seraphim, but then they get assigned to one of these subcategories, and you're suspecting, so there must be some wisdom, higher wisdom assessment going on, because it's probably not a coincidence that those that need to have greater integrity here do. And sure enough, you put it to the test, and that's the way it worked out. Very few of them rebelled, whereas vast numbers of some of these other subgroups did. So it's a lot like with the prince's staff. There's nothing coincidental that Van and his group were loyal. And other, divisions of the prince's staff weren't loyal. Those on high made sure that the most integrous individuals out of those 100 were the 10 in Van's group. There's nothing coincidental about that. The fix was in from the beginning. The most highs made sure that if there was any issue that came up, that at least Van and the other 9 would be rock solid. So they stack the deck, on that. And see, you're seeing something's going on here too. Someone has noticed that it's pretty likely that these could handle a really tough situation, and sure enough, very few didn't pass the test.
Justice is very grounding.
Yeah.
I think that's what I was trying to say.
Yeah, and Kent,
very grounding in your mind.
Justice is very grounding in your mind, and then the challenge is there. That the details, of exactly what these beings are doing in terms of this spiritual ministry as justice guides, is beyond our imagination. So it's transcendent of our imagination and yet very foundationally grounding at the same time. To material beings, even, it's grounding. See, so again, it's a challenge to begin to appreciate that in a cosmic sense, you know, when you have true unity and true individuality, see, they're together in one system. And it can be the highest of high and the most foundational at the same time. True justice is not just the slice down at the bottom, very separated from true mercy, you know, at the top or something. It's you know, you want to stop thinking so simplistically vertically like that. You want justice and mercy to be side by side in some sense and blended together into a harmony. You know, so there's really just one fact, and there's just two ways of abstracting it. You can look at it from the individuality point of view, or you can look at it from the unity point of view. And you know, we'll see that as we, you know, continue to go through with these various things. They touch upon that. All right. Let's see, anything else there?
So when
okay, go ahead.
You know, misled and deluded.
Oh yeah, yeah.
By the sophistries of the umbrella of personal freedom. The misled and deluded part. You know, when I first read about this, and how did angels get in default, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Geez, they think they know better.
Yeah, right.
Or whatever.
Right.
I think their bosses would too.
Well, what it does is, to me, it makes me realize, remember they say they're just a little bit above you.
Right.
It makes you realize that, you know, even though you think of them as being so, before you read your answer, right, being so incredible,
right,
or right next
so,
to God.
So lofty, so yes, yeah, right, right.
It brings it right down to the fact, yeah, that, you know, I imagine we might have been misled.
Oh, yeah. You want to be very humbly sobered by what would have happened if you were on the first or second mansion world 200,000 years ago. Would you have passed the test?
No.
You know.
The thing is that the people who you're looking at, who were there, who were such high beings, are telling you, come on now, this is what we're doing.
Yeah.
You know, it might be easy to be misled, wouldn't you,
right,
think?
Right. Yeah.
I mean, see, maybe not on purpose.
Right. Well, see, so there's two things there. You know, when we're, you know, ignorant and immature, we are very dependent on our superiors, on leaders. So, you know, so we can be misled. And then at the same time, if we're very immature and, you know, and ignorant, we can be delusional. You know, it's very easy for us to take something that's far from ideal and falsely exalted in our minds, you know, deluded, you know, and thinking that it's ideal. So, you know, between the two, the fact that you have angels that can easily falsely exalt something in their minds, just like we can, and they are very dependent on their superiors, you know, it's a lethal combination. And many, 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 you know, joined the rebellion. You know, I'm sure it was just horrendous, the losses, especially in the first mansion world. There must have been so many ascenders that were lost.
I personally think there's a lot of people on earth today that are got caught up in this unbridled personal liberty.
Yeah.
Maybe it's a different level.
Yes.
Yeah, human level is difficult.
All right. So let's, yeah, just, you know, let's, I was going to emphasize that just before we started, you know, that sophistries of unbridled personal liberty. I mean, those who have read the, you know, the Revelation know they invoke that unbridled personal liberty expression a number of times talking about the rebellion. You know, why is it a sophistry? Okay, remember, the word liberty, in its proper sense, is a spirit word, very high spirit word, a very powerful spirit word. You know, if you give that word true form in your mind, or genuine, let's say genuine form in your mind, it will burn. You know, the energy is very powerful associated with that, giving the word liberty genuine form in your mind. You know, it's a very passionate word, the fact behind that word. But, you know, no greater problem. You know, there's an inability to distinguish between true and false liberty in the wake of the rebellion. You know, so that's, it's why is it a sophistry? Why is it more than a fallacy? Why is there a sophistry associated with this? You know, a sophistry, remember, is not just deceptive, like a fallacy. A sophistry is seductive. It's a fallacy plus. The plus is you take the fallacy and you wrap it in spiritual candy. Okay? So that you can't see the fallacy. And it's, you know, deceptiveness. You know, there's this very beautiful, enticing spirit thing, like liberty. You paint liberty all around the absence of personal responsibility and self-control, right? You take that absence of personal responsibility and self-control, and you encase it in the word liberty, and you call the guy that's, you know, preaching this the God of liberty, right?
America's built on
it. Right. America's exactly. Built on it, right? And see, it's a, you know, but that's why it's a sophistry. It's because of the word liberty. The fact that that's a potentially spiritual candy word, you know, if it's not true, liberty. If it's false liberty, what's inside that spiritual candy, you know, if it's hollow, if it's the absence of personal responsibility and self-control, then you have false liberty. See, someone doesn't have insight. If they can't penetrate through the spiritual candy to look inside, in sight, they will fall. They're not sophistry proof. Okay? And angels have limited insight to begin with, just like we have limited insight to begin with. So it's easy for us to just see the surface and think and just extrapolate. Well, on the surface, it's beautiful. So it's like that all the way to the core. No, it may be a whited sepulcher full of dead man's bones. Adam's inability to take delight in cultivating the insight to penetrate through, that juicy spiritual nugget that's put out there for you by a clever, you know, silver-tongued demagogue like Lucifer, or like lots of humans that deceive people all the time the same way. You give them some juicy little spiritual thing and your mind just goes blank. It's like, I can turn my brain off. He said the magic spirit word. So I can just turn my brain off and just follow anything he says. That's the way they get you. Now that's the hook. You know, a spiritual hook is much more enticing than a material hook. You know, if they can give you a spiritual hook and you're not discriminating, you know, you're lost. You know. So that's what's going on here. That very powerful spirit word liberty was being manipulated by a silver-tongued individual. Okay, so now subgroup three here, interpreters of cosmic citizenship. Before we get into the details, let's remind ourselves the pattern we were seeing. We went from spirit coordinators to social architects, now to interpreters of cosmic citizenship, and we were noticing that it was very clear to see unity, associativity, individuality in that order with those three. Cosmic citizenship, we're going to be talking about you, the individual, becoming a genuine cosmic citizen. You know, you are fully individuated into the cosmic citizenship when you reach the system headquarters world. That's what this is going to be about. You know, that bit about becoming fully a full Marantia individuality. You know, and then you can take it and socialize it at the constellation level. And then you can bring it into relationship with unity at the local universe headquarters level. But step one is to become a definitive individual. And if you are rejecting, individuality, that's very bad. I should let go of that. I need to just melt into the unity. Humans that think that way, these angels are trying to work with them, trying to get them to not dismiss individuality like that, to overemphasize your spiritual consciousness and dismiss individuality. No, you need to be, step one is to get yourself solidified, you know, and then you can do something. But until you're a solid self, you know, it's just, you're deluding yourself if you think you're somehow really integrated into the cosmic system. You can't integrate nothing into the cosmic system. You got to be a something first. You know, you can't just be your imagination of something. You got to actually be something. Okay, so that's what these angels are about.
Number three, interpreters of cosmic citizenship. When ascending mortals have completed the mansion world training, the first student apprenticeship in the universe career, they are permitted to enjoy the transient satisfactions of relative maturity. Citizenship on the system capital. While the attainment of each ascendant goal is a factual achievement, in the larger sense, such goals are simply milestones on the long ascending path to paradise. But however relative such successes may be, no evolutionary creature is ever denied the full, though transient, satisfaction of goal attainment. Ever and anon, there is a pause in the paradise ascent, a short breathing spell, during which universe horizons stand still. Creature status is stationary, and the personality tastes the sweetness of goal fulfillment.
See, you as an individual, right? Notice how they're not going to directly kind of bring in that technicality that I just did before we started reading. They want you to, you know, put those pieces together like we have now of seeing the pattern of unity, associativity, individuality. But see, notice how they're fostering that. If you really reflect on this, it's like, well, wait a minute. This is, you know, me as an individual creature having this sweetness of goal attainment. You know, see, it's there. It's about you as an individual. That's. They don't say, well, now don't you go thinking that you should, you know, draw some satisfaction about what you've achieved here as an individual. You know, you need to melt yourself into a blob with everyone else. No. See, all those ideas that humans have along that line, see, they're trying to teach you here, that's false. No. I mean, God made you an individual. He didn't make you a completed individual, so yeah, there's some work to be done. But the solution to your immature individuality isn't to de-individuate. It's to individuate better. Become well-formed as an individual. Something that can become one of the hands of God working in the universe. God needs hands. He can't be handless. So that everyone just melts into a, you know, an unindividuated blob, right? You know, I get a bunch of things here. Let's, and then we'll go here.
I'll talk to people that are like into the Course in Miracles or the Science of Mind, and it's trying to get beyond the ego. And I don't attack it, but I try to gently remind them, because there are Urantia Book readers too, that, you know, what the Urantia Book emphasizes, and I particularly like paper 103 where it talks about the thought adjuster of a child and how it works, and how it places a slight preference for the altruistic impulse over the ego factors of personality. You know, I mean, these are another grounding factor is that ego.
Right.
It just doesn't blow past the ego and say the ego's wrong.
Right. See, and again, I mean, there's such simple things about the word ego, for instance, Do you know the difference between egoistic and egotistic? If you don't, you're never going to understand how any of this works. I mean, you got to at least start there and know the difference between those two words, you know. And so often, the word ego is used as a synonym for egotism. Okay, egotism is an issue. That's a someone who's at a biologic age where they should have some consciousness beyond the end of their nose. Okay? That's egotism. But egoism, there's nothing negative about that. That's the way God made you. You know? That little innocent two-year-old is nothing but egoistic. Exactly the way God made that child. You know, you start out self-centered. And you're supposed to. That's not because the earth is fallen or something like that. If there hadn't been a rebellion and a fall, little children would have been born altruistic. No. You start out selfish by design. Because before you're trying to motivate this. Step one is to get yourself solidly individuated. And they bias that in the fact that, you know, you're just naturally selfish when you're a little child. You know, one of your first words is, mine. That's because God made you that way. And it's not because the parents have failed to teach their child to be altruistic or something. You're supposed to start out, you know, by recognizing, in a very indirect way, that it's important to be you, an individual, to not, you know, let yourself just spread into the four winds. Okay? Now, you know, we got over here.
Well, I just wanted to mention both of the gifts of the Universal Father, personality and the adjuster, are gifts to an individual.
Mm-hmm.
And only an individual can make a moral choice. Groups of they can reflect the moral choice of individuals.
Right.
But a group cannot make a moral choice.
A group can be ethical, but a group can't be moral. Only an individual can be moral. Everything is founded upon cosmic citizens. The entire universe of universes is predicated on very rock-solid, individuated cosmic citizens. So there's a lot to be learned here about why there's problems on this planet right now, because we've begun to falsely exalt this de-individuation, thinking that the word ego is an evil, negative word. No, the word ego is a Latin word that means the self-aware self. Okay, is that bad? Oh, yeah, I should stop being a self-aware self. I should reject the Holy Spirit. I should reject anything being self-evident. I should reject my objective consciousness. Is that what you want to do? Make yourself as animalistic as you can? Because that's what they unwittingly do, these people, you know, that try to very aggressively suppress their individuality. What they're doing is just turning themselves into a fancy animal. Yeah. They're dehumanizing themselves.
And meanwhile, a lower level of people takes over
planet. Right, and people, you know, people say, no, I'm not dehumanizing myself. I'm this very spiritual person. No, you're just a fancy animal. You have a sixth adjutant, and the animals that you're looking at don't. But what about your seventh adjutant and its connection to the Holy Spirit and the Spirit of Truth and a thought adjuster and angelic ministry? You don't have any of that. You just got some amped up mind energy. It has the sixth adjutant making all these zealous unity things coursing in your consciousness. You know, you can bliss out with it and stuff like that. But, you know, God can't do anything with that. I mean, that's calling it blissing out. See, is a de-individuating thing. If you de-individuate, what's God going to do with you? you can't love another person if you're de-individuated. You have to be a rock-solid individual in order to love another person. You know, there's just so many things.
Then there's the whole self-aggrandizement part, you know, or the self, you know, what they say, the work's important, the self is not. If you take the self out of it, you can get a lot more done. So there's semantics in what you're saying in terms of the...
Right.
well, it's just like everything else we've been reading, you know. There's a do and there's a don't.
You've got to understand it in context, yes. I mean... when they say the work is important, the self is not. Well, if there is no self, is there going to be any work? No. See,
self-aggrandizement is used quite a bit.
Right. Again, ego, you don't want egotism. You don't want false exaltation of self. You don't want a delusional self. You want a humble self, a patient self, a loyal self.
Not a self.
You know, but it has to be a self. I mean, the personality is not a thing. It's an influence imposed upon a self. If you de-individuate the self, what's the personality going to do? There's nothing for it to identify with. It can't identify with the everything. It can only identify with an individuated self.
But, you know, and the whole password of the universe is service, which is, you know, not necessarily putting yourself ahead of other selves.
You have to be a self.
So there's a neighbor as yourself.
Right.
There's semantics in, you know, as you go through this. And
right. It's just the, I mean, it's good to diminish self, you know, tendencies towards self-esteem or self-admiration. You want to diminish those. You want to have, you know, self-respect, but don't take it up to self-esteem or self-admiration. So you want to de-aggrandize that self, but all good things taken to extreme become bad. See, so it's good when you've lowered self-admiration down to self-esteem, and it's good if you lower self-esteem down to self-respect, but it becomes bad if you take that down until there's no self. Right? There's a balance point in the middle. You know, and your sixth adjutant doesn't know about such things. It knows about two things, that rail and that rail. And it either slams you against the rails on the left end or it slams you against the rail on the right end. And that's all that zeal knows how to do. And so there's no wisdom. There's no recognition of the balance, that there's an appropriate level of self-integrity.
But that's what we learn, isn't it, over time?
Well, that's what, yeah. You know, and if you aren't taught it or you don't learn it, the angels will start building speed bumps to help you to learn it. Yeah. All right. Okay. All right. So that's, you see, this invokes this whole, you know, this is a very important thing. If we're going to improve where we are right now as a people, we need cosmic citizens. You know, the fifth epical revelation is here to say, yes, you're a child of God, as you were told 2,000 years ago, but you need to take it up a notch. You need to do something with that. You need to become a cosmic citizen. And that means you've got to more solidly individuate than you can by just identifying with the fourth epical revelation. That's just sparking you going. And if you fixate on that, all good things taken to extreme, and if you just try to go towards that light and just melt into the unity, then you lose your individuality. So we're trying to find that balance.
The first of such periods in the career of a mortal ascender occurs on the capital of a local system. During this pause, you will, as a citizen of Jerusalem, attempt to express in creature life those things which you have acquired during the 8 preceding life experiences, embracing Urantia and the 7 mansion worlds.
Okay, so just, again, think about what that's a little short paragraph, see, a little vignette, but think about it in the context we're describing. You now finally have yourself all collected and solidly focused. And so now you can express out of that focus point all of the potential that's built up over those 8 lives. It finally can be brought to a sharp focus and expressed in a way that it can never be expressed before. You've wanted to express some of that, but the lens wasn't focused, you know, and so when you expressed it, just was this fog blur. But now, it's this laser beam that comes out of you, you know, that can serve another or love another, right? That's, you finally have the lens focused, so that the cosmos can shine through you and be focused to a point to help another person. If you can't focus that love to a point, you know, I mean, I can't help Chris when I beam it out, it fills the whole room. I got to focus it on Chris.
Doubtful that you're going to help.
I've got to be able to bring an individuality into relationship with the unity.
Don't take that
in order to apply it.
I know, too far down.
Yep.
I was going to say, it's just got to be side effects of the rebellion, because, you know, when Lucifer dropped, I mean, when he lost his vertical dimension, you know, the tent pole in the center, I mean, it collapsed, you know. I mean, he put everything on a horizontal plane, but he still had this spirit nature, I guess. And it just went out horizontally, and it didn't have any vertical dimension anymore, and it just did exactly what you're talking about. It just, you know, this is how we love, this is how we, you know, it was just...
Right, if it can't be focused, if it has no definitive, it's just magical thinking.
Yeah,
right? You know, Lucifer is thinking magically when he thinks, oh, we're just going to be this wonderful confederation of, you know, of worlds. You know, like it just, you know, where if we just say spirit, we're all one. No, that's not how it works. Okay? You know, so again, you know, we all know there's that tendency to think, well, if we just somehow take a hold of the fact that we're kindred spirits, you know, especially now post-Pentecost, we all have adjusters by grace, then boom, we're going to have peace on earth and the brotherhood of man. No. Peace on earth and brotherhood of man is kindred minds, not merely kindred spirits. Kindred spirits is just the potential for kindred minds. And again, you have to take that unity of kindred spiritness and bring it, you know, into a focus in you and out from you. You have to bring individuality into relationship to that unity. All right. Let's see, what else was there? Remember maybe in passing, when they bring up these issues like eight preceding life experiences, you know, remember how definitive it is to start with as you're going through the mansion worlds. You know, you basically die seven times. Now, you die here to get to the first mansion world, and you die to get, you know, to the subsequent mansion worlds. You know, but you leave behind that last resurrection chamber on the seventh mansion world. So you're now in this mode where all of that really coarse developmental effort is behind you, and you're a citizen on Gerasimsi. So that goes hand in hand with this. Okay, I'm finally, it took seven deaths, but I finally have myself put together. You know, it was pretty harsh medicine to build this, but I finally have a solid individual now. Now I'm going to start doing something with it.
That sounds great.
Really?
Yeah. I'm dying to get there.
Very literally, you're dying to get there.
Nobody can help that.
Okay.
The seraphic interpreters of cosmic citizenship guide the new citizens of the system capitals and quicken their appreciation of the responsibilities of universe government. These seraphim are also closely associated with the material suns in the system administration, while they portray the responsibility and morality of cosmic citizenship to the material mortals on the inhabited worlds.
Did they mention responsibility? I see personal responsibility and self-control. And again, I can have a recognition of personal responsibility, but if I've de-individuated myself, how am I going to have self-control? There's no self to control. Okay? The whole point is to do something with that recognition of personal responsibility, control a self. That's what God wants you to do. He gave you a personality so it could control a self, you know, and that self could one day be perfected. You know, your personality doesn't need perfecting. It's yourself that needs perfecting, and that's the whole point. You know, so again, you're just totally cutting yourself off from the whole concept of the ascension scheme and everything. If you're in this mode where you think what you're supposed to do is somehow blur the self into nothing, it's going the wrong direction. You know, you think you're going towards light and life, and you're going the opposite direction. All right, so there it is, very, very definitively, this cosmic citizenship and seeing that real definitive responsibility, morality, you know, and like Gene was saying, that moral consciousness is an individual fact. Oh, look what comes next, the quickeners of morality. Okay, and remind yourself where the previous subgroup number four was. You know, when we were in associativity, it was the ethical sensitizers. Right? That was the associativity. Right? So before you can be helped by the ethical sensitizers, you need to be helped by the quickeners of morality. You've got to have a definitive moral consciousness before that can be socialized in an ethical consciousness. All right.
Number four, quickeners of morality. On the mansion worlds, you begin to learn self-government for the benefit of all concerned. Your mind learns cooperation, learns how to plan with other and wiser beings. On the system headquarters, the seraphic teachers will further quicken your appreciation of cosmic morality, the interactions of liberty and loyalty.
Ah, the interactions of liberty and loyalty. So that whole bit we were talking about, true and false liberty, and personal responsibility, self-control. So they toss out the word loyalty here.
Yeah.
Okay. We want to think about that word loyalty, as I've pointed out a few times here recently. Remember, it's just like when you're thinking about true mercy and true justice, where it's two sides of the same fact. With loyalty, when you look at it from a unity viewpoint, it's loyalty. If you flip it around and look at it from an individuality viewpoint, it's legality. The words loyal and legal are the same Latin word, literally. Okay, it's literally the same word. The reason you have two different words, you know, that have been derived from that same root is because there's two different ways to look at the same fact. In a unity sense, where I'm loyal, and then all the details, legality. Just like law and love are the same fact looked at from the two sides. Okay, so see that whole bit about personal responsibility, self-control, all the specificity of controlling a multifaceted self. You know, every time they say loyalty, remind yourself that's also legality. All of the specificity, all the details. You know, we had justice guides here also, remember? So that bit, you know, it starts with a duty to the cosmos. You know, there's that basic moral consciousness. There's no individuals. There's this you and the cosmos. And you have a duty to it. You're going to be loyal to the cosmos. Okay? And there's a legal side of that. There's all kinds of specificity to that. There's all kinds of details of that. It isn't just one, you know, blissy thing that you meld into. Okay? But we're focusing on the unity side here, the loyalty side. I'm going to be loyal to the cosmos. And then I'm going to take that loyalty to the cosmos, and I'm going to say, oh, yeah, and there's others. And so I can build upon that, going from morality to ethics, and I can have a loyalty to others. And then there's the others. You know, we could just say the other, God, but, you know, we know there actually is a number of individuals who are personalized deities, so let's go ahead and just say it in the plural. There are the others, so there's that loyalty to God as well, but it builds up, it starts with you. You can't be loyal to God if you don't start with the foundational element where there's just you and the cosmos. So, like, for instance, I'm eventually going to get to the point where I'm loyal to God the Father. I have to start with being loyal to the cosmos, the universal harmony, which is the presence of God the Mother. That's where I start. I'm loyal to the cosmos. I'm loyal to God the Mother, see, technically, behind that. You know, and then I bring in others, and then I bring in the other. Like, if I'm just focused on God the Father, say. Okay, so again, if you've totally cut yourself off, you know, at square one by trying to defocus yourself, de-emphasize the self because you think it's evil. I am by nature sinful and unclean. If you're in a Western mode, or if you're in an Eastern mode and you're really trying to just, you know, totally fuzz the self out into unity, you know, either mode you're in, no. That's your starting point. You have to ground your individuality in the cosmos. And then if there's a grounded individual, that individual could have a relationship to God. But a unity doesn't have a relationship to God. An individual has a relationship to God. I mean, especially when you're talking about God the Father. God the Father can't relate to, you know, two individuals even at the same time. He can only relate to one individual absolutely, and that individual absolutely, and then, you know, and it's as if there are no other individuals when it's relating to one individual, God the Father. You know? See, so, I mean, if you have that, think how delusional it is if you've really de-emphasized your individuality and then you say, but I have a really strong relationship with God the Father. No, you don't. That's impossible. If you're not a solid individual, you're delusional if you think you can have a relationship with God the Father if you've de-individuated yourself like that. So there's a lot here that is trying to challenge the biases we've built up by over favoring our spiritual consciousness, you know, using it as an end in itself rather than the beginning of something greater.
I just don't think most people are aware.
Right.
I mean, that's semantics of the word.
I know, right. See, that's the thing. There's just so many things. That's what the fifth epoch of Revelation, see, is finally trying to teach us all of this complexity. And it's important.
There.
Right? There's a desire, is there? I mean, people are as sincere as the day is long. But you got to know exactly what you're up to a little bit. You know? You can't just say, well, I don't have to worry about the details because spirit is innately divine. Well, wait a minute. Lucifer is a blob of spirit energy, and I don't think he's very innately divine right now. So you can't go make that assumption. Apparently you can do some pretty negative things with a blob of spirit energy. It's not innately divine.
It's just self-animating.
It's self-animating. So it'll go to divinity or iniquity, you know, very rapidly, if you let it. But
it also says you don't have to beat yourself up if you can't remember all the details.
No, no. Right. Again, we're not trying to cram all this into this life. You know, I mean, we're mostly reading about what we're going to be doing once we get going. And a lot of this, you really can't do in earnest until you become a Gerasim citizen. You know, it's just several lives away.
Right?
No, but loyalty. So let's see what they say here.
What is loyalty? It is the fruit of an intelligent appreciation of universe brotherhood. One could not take so much and give nothing. As you ascend the personality scale, first you learn to be loyal, then to love, then to be filial, and then may you be free. But not until you are a finaliter, not until you have attained perfection of loyalty, can you self-realize finality of liberty.
Remember how we talked about the legal side before? You know, that once you finally can fully engage absolute law, then you will finally be free. Your personality will finally have full liberty of function. You know, we're just looking, you know, flip it around the other way. Instead of saying absolute law, call it absolute loyalty. Same fact, looked at from two different ways.
Can you talk about that first sentence?
Okay, so. Let's go to the second one, go to the one after that first, and then you'll understand that one better. So this whole bit about what is loyalty, and then they say these various things. Notice what they say, as you ascend the personality scale, first you learn to be loyal, then to love, then to be filial. Okay, all in response to loyalty. So in other words, they're saying, okay, there's loyalty in a general sense, but let's say, well, kind of in a more specific sense, we'll say, first you learn to be loyal, loyal to the cosmos, moral consciousness. Yeah. Okay, step two, I'm going to be loyal to others. Well, let's use a different word. I'm going to love others. Okay, and then loyalty to our parents, our deity parents, filial. See, it's just that sequence I was talking about before. Loyalty to the cosmos, loyalty to others, loyalty to the others, your parents, God the Father, God the Mother, filial. Now, this sequence is nothing new if you remember the last section of the book. Paper 196, section 3, there's a list in there, these three different loyalties we're talking about here. Loyalty to the cosmos, loyalty to others, and loyalty to the others. I mean, if you want to see what I'm specifically referring to. You flip to the last section there. As you get into that last section a little bit, there's two lists of three. There's a list of the second list of three, where it says before it says the moral values of the universe become intellectual possessions of the by the exercise of the three basic judgments or choices of the mortal mind. Self-judgment, moral choice; social judgment, ethical choice; God judgment, religious choice. Okay, this is the three we're talking about here. Okay. Loyalty to, say it in the duty sense here. Duty to the cosmos, duty to others, duty to God. That's a fundamental developmental sequence that they're trying to teach us in various places in the book. Okay, so see, in that full sense, you know, what is loyalty? It is the fruit of an intelligent appreciation of universe brotherhood. Okay, I mean, if you put the cosmos and the others all together into one cosmic system, you know, then you can talk about that full universe brotherhood. Not just brotherhood, see, but universe brotherhood, the cosmic system of brotherhood. And it has those three aspects to it that have built up. You know, the fruit, how you will manifest as an individual, your fruits. You know, by your fruits you will be known. People will be able to look at you, and they'll be able to see your loyalty to the cosmos, your loyalty to others, your loyalty to the others, you know, your loyalty to the gods, all together in a harmony, manifesting as the fruits of your intelligent, you know, harmonization, synchronization with the cosmos. And so that's what they're getting at there. I mean, and see, they a lot of times, you know, they'll say it in a less technical way like that, so that you can maybe start kind of feeling it.
Like the next sentence.
You know, when it says it is the fruit of an intelligent appreciation of universe brotherhood. Okay, you don't have to get all technical on that. There's an element of that statement that you can kind of feel, you can desire, you can try to start striving for. And then as you mature, you can begin to appreciate the details of it. You know, that there's, you know, this loyalty to the cosmos, loyalty to others, loyalty to the other. You know, it has all this complexity to it. You know, kind of the legality of the loyalty, the individuality of the unity. But they try to give you, they know that many people aren't going to initially be just right there ready to grab a hold of these specificities in kind of a scientific fashion and start engaging them. You know, it's like, well, give me something that I can initially kind of feel where I'm going, and then I'll try to start working on the details. I know you're encouraging me to, so I will, but get me going first. I mean, that's what Jesus was here to do, to get us going with what you kind of feel. And then the fifth epical revelation is here to start getting you into the details now. It's like, what have you been trying to feel your way towards? You know? So, is there a question on the webinar?
Yeah. Our first step on this planet is to progress toward treating all others with genuine brotherhood? Question.
Well, I mean, obviously that's a goal, to be striving for treating others in a genuine brotherhood. But remember what we're trying to stress here. Don't think that you just jump to that. Tomorrow, we're going to be brotherly, you know. If you haven't individuated yourself as a cosmic citizen yet, if you haven't taken delight in cultivating, being a nugget of courageous and independent cosmic thinking, there's not going to be any genuineness. You're not going to actually succeed, except, you know, in your own imagination, you know, in this brotherhood thing. You know, you'll have to constantly say that you're a brotherhood, because, you know, every time you actually look at it closely, it doesn't seem like it actually is. It seems like it's a lot of fighting and immaturity. Right? You know, I mean, why is it that that desire to be a brotherhood doesn't just happen? You know, why is it when you actually go forward year after year, there's, you know, all this backstabbing and whatnot that goes on? It's because you skipped step one. Individuals of integrity. You know, I mean, think about the simple hierarchy of the levels of meaning. You know, you want to be merciful. Well, what do they say? Do you just, you know, tomorrow just jump right to mercy? No, you first just, next fair, then patient, then kind, and then and only then can you be merciful. It's like, well, let's start with step one, just. You know, honest and law-abiding. Think about the run-of-the-mill idealist who wants to be merciful, but you know, the laws of the nation are kind of a suggestion, And, you know, honesty's for when, you know, someone's looking. Right? I mean, if that's where you're starting, you think you can fuzz out that just level. I mean, you can't even get to fair, let alone merciful. You're delusional. You know? So it's and again, to be just, you have to be an individual. You have to have enough individuation that you appreciate why there's all this specificity and individuality and laws, what that's about, rather than, oh, laws, schmaws. I mean, who needs all that complexity? Let's just love one another.
Well, that was what they said was...
That's the way it works.
The Midwayers said was basically wrong with Judas. He really wasn't even honest with himself.
Right.
And that's the ground floor. If you can't, you know, so right. He was just, you know.
Right, right. See, if you don't even have first just, honest and law-abiding, I mean, you're not going to get anywhere except in your delusions.
Yeah. So why do they throw in this, one cannot take so much and give nothing?
Right. So that's why I just recognize. Even forget about others. Just when you really recognize there's a cosmos, and that you are constantly benefiting from that. The very fact that I can complete sentences, that I'm not psychologically insane, that I'm not just a blithering idiot, okay, is a gift of the cosmos to my mind. The encirclement of the Holy Spirit gives me an anchor in the integrity and stability of the cosmos that allows me to be psychologically sound. If you snip that cord that connects me to the cosmos, I'll be, you know, a blithering idiot. You have to put me in a straitjacket. And I mean, I'll go psychologically insane. My mind isn't self-sustaining. It's sustained. To him who has been given so much like that, when you recognize how much you just take for granted that you're given, right, so that's what they're talking about. You know, you cannot take so much and give nothing. Right? The cosmos gave you sanity by grace. What are you doing with that sanity? Are you being
hiding it in a bushel?
Right.
Like that.
What are you doing with that sanity that you were given?
Pretty much everything you're given.
Right. Everything. We're creatures. We're not creators. We don't have anything except by grace. You know, I didn't assemble the molecules of my body or anything. All right.
Very humbling.
These seraphim teach the fruitfulness of patience. The stagnation is certain death, but that over rapid growth is equally suicidal. That as a drop of water from a higher level falls to a lower level, and flowing onward passes ever downward through a succession of short falls, so ever upward is progress in the Mirantia and spirit worlds, and just as slowly and by just such gradual stages.
Little steps, little stages. Your spiritual consciousness hates such thoughts. It wants to take it all in one big glorious step. It doesn't want tiny little waterfalls that, you know, you're going up. It wants that one giant waterfall that takes you from your benighted plane to paradise, right? In one big step. No, you need lots and lots of patience. What's the threshold to the more glorious facts? What's the neck of the hourglass? Yeah, just, fair, patient, kind, merciful.
Even Fullerton, I read, chapter 44, yeah. Says, with patience and persistence. Yeah.
Patience.
We can figure these things out for ourselves. Right. What's true and what isn't?
Right. I mean, a number of these things humans figured out, you know, but we've forgotten. We need to be reminded about how much we learned about the indispensableness of patience to anything significant in your life.
Comforting.
You know, so and notice one little thing we haven't touched upon. You know, this is group number four. We were talking about. How these are, you know, a thread. Remember how the group number four has been about teachers. Remember, it started really definitively, you know, where you had teaching counselors and assistant teachers, et cetera. you notice how they've thrown that in a couple times here. In the first paragraph, when they say on the system headquarters, the seraphic teachers, here they say these seraphim teach. Okay. And notice how there was kind of this little teaching analogy thing that they threw in there. See how it's being purposely done in a kind of a teaching mode, you know, with a bit about the waterfalls, the little tiny waterfalls. Okay. Let's see. So is there another question? Are we okay on the webinar?
Somebody wanted to just touch up on filial.
Oh, filial, yeah.
Went over, but.
Like the Ten Commandments, honor thy father and thy mother. Okay, that's about being filial. You know, it means of the son, of the daughter. You know, it's just, you know, you recognize that the others are above. They're your parents. You're the child of God.
Source.
Yeah, source. Yeah.
I think the other one is for afterwards.
Okay. All right. Okay, so, just notice how much there's about allowing for smallness, for individuality. Let's take one step, okay? Let's don't, it's like, instead of trying to save the world tomorrow, how about if you try to do a little something to be a more integrous individual? Be one measure more patient, say, tomorrow, or more law-abiding, or more honest tomorrow. Okay, I've used that example all the time. You know, the simplest way to remind yourself of how silly it is to think that your step one is to save the world, is remind yourself of the diameter of the earth. Okay, and then open your mouth as wide as you can. Okay, will the diameter of the earth fit into your mouth? I mean, is the earth an individual-sized task? No. Start with something that fits in your mouth first. This is something that's the size of you first. There's people way above your pay grade that have the earth issue. You know, the Most High's rule in the kingdoms of men. You don't need to save the earth. They've got that covered. People that actually have the kind of arms that can encompass the earth and deal with the earth as a whole. You don't. Start with something, start with a solid individual who's going to start to be a solid individual in the first foundational group, a family. Okay, you're going to be a solid individual, finding other solid individuals, making a solid family, and all of the human institutions are going to be built upon that solid family unit. But there's not going to be a solid family, and there's not going to be any solid human institutions if there aren't solid individuals. It all starts with the individual. Not just a desire, and a belief in magic that, if you just want to be a perfect family, you will be. Right? It just happens magically.
Just ask the Brady. They're watching Perry Mason.
But on the other side of the coin, if you don't want to be, you do have to want to be.
Yeah, you do. Right. It starts with that spiritual impulse. Right,
which you were talking about,
but right
before it gets to the mind.
But that's just the beginning, not the end. Right, it just gets the process started. I mean, all right. Keep going here.
To the inhabited worlds, the quickeners of morality portray mortal life as an unbroken chain of many links. Your short sojourn on your rancho, on this sphere of mortal infancy, is only a single link, the very first in the long chain that is to stretch across universes and through the eternal ages. It is not so much what you learn in this first life, it is the experience of living this life that is important. Even the work of this world, paramount though it is not nearly so important as the way in which you do this work. There is no material reward for righteous living, but there is profound satisfaction, consciousness of achievement, and this transcends any conceivable material reward.
Okay.
Great paragraph.
I love it. Yeah, yeah. I mean, this is you know, really great stuff in here. Okay. I mean, and think about how we already teed this up. We brought, naturally came up. The work is important. Yeah. The self is not. Okay. So think about that. The work is important. The self is not.
And I didn't read it.
Okay. Yeah. And that's why they say even the work of this world, paramount though it is, the paramount though it is the work is important. The self is not. Okay. But see, they're taking it up a notch. Okay. Let's don't think too simplistically about it. There's a quality thing. Not just a quantity thing in play, right? The way that you work, okay?
And by the
end. And if you're talking about, having a proper way about how you work, do you look to the Father for that way, or to the Mother? All right, it's the Father's will. The Father's way is the Mother. That consecration of your mind to the universal harmony of God the Mother, that's the way to do things well. Do it in a way that coordinates with the cosmos. That's the way they're talking about. So any measure of doing it the cosmic way, no matter how small it seems in the grand scheme of things, what you're doing, leads to a brick of soul. In order for you to do something in a cosmic way, that means there has to be a cosmic form in the upper domain of your hourglass. Because that's what your body's motions and whatnot are predicated on, that form. And if there is a cosmic form up there, the adjuster copies that. That you can make a brick soul out of one of those forms. Right? See, so that's why they're saying it that way. It's not nearly so important as the way in which you do this work.
And the power sense before that is a good one too. Right?
Courageous and independent cosmic thinking. You want those cosmic forms. That's the way. Right? I mean, all these things are just, are great to reflect on.
I don't think of that. What you learn in the life versus just the experience of living it.
Right.
I guess when you think about that, they tell you about what you, may personality survival and things like that. What things survive, mm-hmm. what you may remember, may not remember. And so a lot of what you think you is really important, you probably don't even remember. Mm-hmm. Probably doesn't even go along with you. So it's more the fact that you experienced this life. I mean, Jesus experienced it in 30 years or whatever.
Yeah.
But experience the living of a human being.
Right. Right. Think about it. How many beings are there in the universe? Well, they told us as we started studying the beings of the infinite spirit. Say, well, there's more categories of beings than you can even imagine. Okay. So literally the number of beings is really beyond your imagination. How many of those uncountable number of beings can live a mortal life? Think about how think about how relatively unique. I mean, the number of say Havona natives, they tell you it's beyond your numerical concept. Okay. And that's just one drop in the bucket of all the beings that there are in the universe of universes. I mean, being immortal and being able to live a mortal life, that's a really special thing. Can any angel live a mortal life? No. Can any midwayer live a mortal life? No. Can a solitary messenger? Can a divine counselor? None of them can, right? See, and that's the simplest way to just think about it. It's not so much what you learn in this first tiny little short life. This experience of living this life is important. Very few beings have the incredible opportunity to live this kind of a life.
Especially on this kind of a world.
This is really rare.
You never get this opportunity.
Right, almost never. I mean, there's so few people that get a chance to live a life on this kind of a world. Mm-hmm. And if you can just see it as a potential, what you will be able to do with the fact that you live this life, a trillion years from now, that no being will ever be able to do what you can do because you lived this life, no matter how You know, unprofound it seems,
does
you know.
Does it go on that far?
Goes on forever, right?
I mean, do you really,
right? You know? Okay, is a question on the webinar?
The question is, are you, your form, integrus?
Yeah, you noticed I was using the word form a little bit. You know, when we talk about integrity, you know, don't think so materialistically. I mean, yeah, if your limbs are falling off, and it's problematic, okay? You want to have some, you know, literal material integrity to your body, okay? But, you know, remember yourself is not this collection of molecules. You have a mindal self, you know? And it's the forms in that mind energy system that are really important. See, and that's why the way in which you do it, see, what kind of a form do you put in that mind energy system? You know, it's one thing, yeah, I mean, if there's no motion in the mind energy, you know, there's no work, okay, that's problematic. But what about the form of what's working? You know, think about that. Think about having better forms in your mind energy system. Take the light and cultivating. See? Having forms that are like the cosmos. If you make a form that's like the cosmos in any way, all these ministries can help. If the form in the mind energy system doesn't conform with the cosmos, all these ministries that conform with the cosmos can't interface with that form in your mind energy. You know? It's square peg, round hole sort of thing, right? So you can't benefit from any of these things. Now, that's why they tell you, you know, man cannot cause growth, but can supply favorable conditions, right? These are the favorable conditions we're talking about. Having that cosmic form, you know, and then all this stuff interfaces with it, you know, and it leads to growth. Right? All right, let's get some more here.
The keys of the kingdom of heaven are sincerity, more sincerity, and more sincerity. All men have these keys. Men use them, advance in spirit status, by decisions, by more decisions, and by more decisions. The highest moral choice is the choice of the highest possible value, and always, in any sphere, in all of them, this is to choose to do the will of God. If man thus chooses, he is great, though he be the humblest citizen of Jerusalem, or even the least of mortals on Urantia.
Everyone knows that passage pretty well if you've read the book for a long time. Yeah. Let's just point out one little thing. Remind yourself that there's two sequences of triplets. Okay, you need to have that sincerity, that initial spark, but that's not an end in itself. That has to be followed by decisions, and decisions, more decisions, right? You know, a decision is a form in the mind energy system. Is it well formed? Okay, you can be sincere because you consecrated your will to the perfect will of God the Father, but you can't make a well-formed decision if you haven't consecrated your mind to the universal harmony of God the Mother, right? Now, the point is to be actually, and they notice they bring in choice too. You know, remember, it's a spiritual choice, but it's a mindal decision. So you have to take it from that, initially that sincerity is, as a spiritual nature that, and a choice is made that's tied to eternity. But then you bring that choice, that spiritual choice, down into a mindal decision, which is tied to the specifics of the temporal, world around you. That takes all kinds of wisdom to form that decision well.
And you may not make right decisions, and you learn. Doesn't mean you don't make them.
Right. Yeah. I mean, religionists may not always act wisely; they even act irreligiously, but they act. Okay. See that spark. You have to have that spark to get it going, and then just boldly go forth. I mean, always be doing your best to make take a recognition of ideals and translate it into an idea that engages the specificity of the facts around you. But that idea may not work. But don't be afraid to try it out, because it might not work. You know, so many people are too idealistic, they get frozen. It's like, well, yeah, but what if? It's like, no, just do something, okay?
Indecision.
Yeah. God can't steer a parked car. You've got to start driving, you know?
A lot of times the stuff doesn't come to your mind until you've committed yourself to move forward. And then once you move forward, mm-hmm. you know, out of faith, it's like, wow, you know, I'm starting my mind, and you're patient, you're trusting, you know, your mind starts to work.
You may recall Jesus tried to teach that to the apostles. He said, don't worry about it. Just get in the game and it'll come to you.
Yeah, you don't have to worry about
it. Right? Don't try to pre-think it. Trust. See, don't just have mere faith. Trust. Act.
That's where the patience comes in.
Get
trust.
In the game. Trust. You know, and you, when you work on it a while, you discover that the only way you can really explain your life is acknowledging all this help that you're getting. Because things just come to you along the way in the process. It's like, wow, that just came to me, and I knew what to do there. It's because you were in the game. You're part of the dynamic system, and they're working with you. They're helping you. But you know, there's a limit to what they can do when you're just sitting there trying to pre-think everything, you know, in a static mode, in an existential mode. All of experiential deity has no relationship to you when you're in that existential mode. You're not going to get any help in time.
I almost made a decision today.
Okay, so anyway. All right, so let's get the next block here.
Number 5, the transporters. These are the transport seraphim who function in the local systems. In Satania, your system, they carry passengers back and forth from Gerasim and otherwise serve as interplanetary transporters. Seldom does a day pass in which a transport seraphim of Satania does not deposit some student visitor or some other traveler of spirit or semi-spirit nature on the shores of Urantia. These very space traversers will sometime carry you to and from the various worlds of the system headquarters group. And when you have finished the Gerasim assignment, they will carry you forward to Edentia. But under no circumstances will they carry you backward to the world of human origin. A mortal never returns to his native planet during the dispensation of his temporal existence. And if he should return during a subsequent dispensation, he would be escorted by a transport seraphim of the universe headquarters group.
Okay, I mean, that's pretty straightforward. We have this hierarchy of the transporters that you know, we've been coming down through. So obviously we've got the transporters that are just working within the system. And, you know, you notice they reminded you that isn't just between a world and the system headquarters. It can actually be from world to world, too. You know, horizontally, sort of not just vertically, at interplanetary transporters. So anything within the local system, you have transporters that are just assigned to that. Now, the one little thing that they throw in at the end is kind of fun. Okay, you know, a lot of us who have been reading for a long time remember the first part about how you can't return during your dispensation. But you probably forget the last part of that. You know, remind yourself of that last part. See, if you did return, you would be escorted by a transport seraphim of the universe headquarters group. You know, that transporter that we read about, you know, way back up when we were at the local universe headquarters level. It's like, well, why? Got an idea?
Well, probably John the Baptist might be coming back.
All right, so let's bring in that. I was going to bring that up, but let's go ahead and bring that out. Right. So obviously, an example of mortals who have come back to this world, not during their dispensation, but subsequent dispensation, are the 420 counselors coming here as resident governor general, or if they might come for some other reason. But, you know, so that's interesting. See, they're always, their transport seraphim is not down here amongst the administrator seraphim. You know, it's you know, flip your way back. You know, you've got, remember the superior seraphim. You know, those are the ones, you know, they say that the group are headquartered on Salvington, right? So back there in that one. See, so So you go, huh, okay, I hadn't thought about that. So like the 420 counselors, for instance, okay, why can't they use one of these transporter seraphim? Why are they using one from up high? Okay, if they're using one from up high, that means that what they're up to is not just a local issue. And the 420 counselors are a great example. If they're coming here as a divine counsel, or as a resident governor general, who set them up as the 420 counselors to serve in this weird planetary government we have as resident governor general?
Michael
did. Right? It's a local universe issue. The only reason you'd go back to a world, you know, in a subsequent dispensation, if what you're doing is not about the local system or even about the constellation, but it has to do with the whole local universe, you're on a mission at the collective local universe level, not at the local system level.
Interesting.
See, that's what's going on there.
Mission from God.
All right, you're on a mission from
wow.
Michael of Nebadon, you know, Michael on Salvington. Yes. Yep.
There's one important paragraph here.
Mm-hmm.
Our sentence actually about seldom does a day pass which a transport seraphim of Zetania does not deposit some student visitor. Basically, people think because we're quarantined, we're not getting visitors and stuff.
Yeah, remember the quarantine, is just the communication circuits. I mean, remember, you know, even Satan was still coming here by transport, until the beginning of the 20th century. So, I mean, we're not quarantined in the sense of transporters. You know, people are coming and going. You know, and that's, you know, one of the interesting things is all those student visitors that were here at the time Caligastia joined the rebellion. See, that, you know, we've talked about that before. That's probably, see, some of those that are, they mentioned that weren't taken off and are still here. There's some group that they don't described that's still here. They just refer to them at one time in passing. And you can suspect there may be all kinds of beings that we aren't even revealed in here that are low enough that they could rebel, that just happened to be visiting here, got caught up in the rebellion, and
you know, they couldn't possibly be interested in our mundane lives, you know. So so there must be something that they're looking at that would keep them interested.
They say they want to come here.
Yeah, okay, that's a great way to say it. For those of you on the web, she said, they couldn't possibly be interested in our mundane lives. The challenge is, see, we think our lives are mundane. We were just talking about that. A divine counselor looking at your mortal life, knowing there's no way you can remotely live such a life, does it think of your life as mundane? No, it thinks of it as an amazing thing that's completely transcendent of its experiential potential.
Here these guys are down there, they know nothing, and yet they have...
To ever get hungry and decide to eat a hot dog, that's beyond the experiential range of a divine counselor.
Okay.
I mean, just try to remind yourself, we take all this stuff for granted, but a lot of the universe doesn't look at us as the bottom. They look at us as at the top. You know, how did Michael look at his life here? It wasn't going to the bottom. It was going to the top. And remember, they tell you that he reached the apex of his entire experiential career when he finally got to what we think is the horrid bottom, you know, the scourging and stuff. No, that was, he left the Isle of Paradise. You know, and yeah, he descended in a sense. He went from an absolute domain down to a finite domain, you could say. But experientially, he's going up. He starts at the Isle of Paradise and goes up. And he reached the heights of what he can experience going up from the Isle of Paradise in terms of finite experience when he got to the scourging and the crucifixion. That's way above the Isle of Paradise, those experiences. Paradise citizens, you know, oh man, imagine if you could actually go that high. Right? See, you got to remember, you got to flip it around. All experience is going up, you know, from the center of all things. You know, the Isle is the embodiment of everything that can be in existence before there was experience. So it's the foundation. Everything is up from there. You can't get any lower than the Isle of Paradise. That's the foundation of the cosmos infinite. That's the bottom. It's the bottom floor. Everything is above the aisle. You know, I mean, what you're doing in getting to the aisle, in many ways, is trying to get to the starting point, trying to get to the bottom, so that you can actually start really going up, right? We all need to challenge ourselves to stop, you know, thinking that this life is, I mean, Michael's, you know, incarnation here, living this mundane life, was the pinnacle of all his seven incarnations. Mm-hmm. Not the lowliest of them. Yeah. Right, so yeah. To turn everything around, think about it in a more true way.
The last shall be.
You know, we're going to look back and think, wow. It's a good thing that there's a number of things that we do kind of by grace, because I was so clueless, I would have done nothing with that unique, fleeting opportunity if God hadn't primed me well, and so I did a number of things unwittingly, you know? If I had to do it all, if it had all been, you know, dependent upon being aware of it in advance, I would have squandered the whole life.
I would never have read that book.
Yeah.
Is that because we have inevitabilities here that you don't have available?
Yeah, that's one way to think about it. The inevitabilities is a great way to think about that. I mean, there's so many potentials here that aren't even remotely present in Havana or on the Isle. Right? Those inevitabilities aren't there. There is no differential. So there's no way to bridge that gap there. There's so much potential here. All right, let's wrap up here before it gets too late.
Let's see. The recorders?
Yep, so we're on the recorders.
Number six, the recorders. These seraphim are the keepers of the threefold records of the local systems. The temple of records on a system capital is a unique structure. One-third material constructed of luminous metals and crystals, one-third morontial, fabricated of the liaison of spiritual and material energy, but beyond the range of mortal vision, and one-third spiritual. The recorders of this order preside over and maintain these threefold system of records. Ascending mortals will at first consult the material archives, material suns, and the higher transition beings consult those of the Marantia halls, while seraphim and the higher spirit personalities of the realm peruse the records of the spirit section.
Probably, you know, most of that's just right there. Let me just, you know, emphasize. Notice this is one of those spots in the book where you're challenged to think of spirit very literally as a substance. Okay, now there's a building made out of spirit substance and records made out of spirit substance, and you know, it's not, being spiritual is not a feeling that you get in your mind. Spirit is a substance, you know, and that fact is so removed from the way you've always used the word spiritual prior to the fifth epical revelation, that should challenge you. It's like, no, there's bricks. You go and there's this building that's made out of spirit bricks. Okay, it's a substance.
I think it's all the same records in three different forms.
Yeah. It's just, you know, you literally have three different ways that you can put grooves in matter, you can put grooves in Marantia, and you can put grooves in spirit. You know, and you can play the three different records.
Cosmic Rosetta Stone.
Right. It's like a Rosetta Stone, right? Where you have all three languages, you know, as it were, sort of, you know, together there and, you know, in one place. Yep. You know, and then the higher you get, the more you can you know, think about all three records simultaneously. Because, you know, you have a Marantia body, but you're perusing the material records initially. Because, you know, even finaliters still have a relationship to material things. And so more and more you can see it in triune fashion. All right.
Yep.
Seven. Number seven, the reserves.
The reserve corps of administrator seraphim on Gerasim spend much of their waiting time in visiting. As spirit companions with the newly arrived ascending mortals from the various worlds of the system, the accredited graduates of the mansion worlds. One of the delights of your sojourn on Gerasim will be to talk and visit during recess periods with these much traveled and many experienced seraphim of the waiting reserve corps. It is just such friendly relationships as these that so endear a system capital to the ascending mortals. On Gerasim, you will find the first intermingling of material sons, angels, and ascending pilgrims. Here, fraternized beings who are wholly spiritual and semi-spiritual and individuals just emerging from material existence. Mortal forms are there so modified and human ranges of flight reaction so extended that all are able to enjoy mutual recognition and sympathetic personality understanding.
It's kind of just maybe the fun thing there to reflect on. Notice how, they, again, they're reminding you of the literalness, you know, and they, you know, light reaction, you know, and remember you got three different substances, so you have light in three different ways, you know, relative to those three different substances, you know, so that literal scientific, you know, or physics picture combined with sympathetic personality understanding. You know, look at how fully harmonized that thought is, you know, challenging you to think of it in scientific fashion and your highest personality desires at the same time. You know, that brotherhood of closeness that's possible. And see, like I was saying, when they bring up the recorders in the threefold, notice how they're emphasizing it here again. See, that you can, you'll start to actually be able to do the threefold thing much more directly because it's all in front of you. You remember, Marantia substance is, you can kind of think of it as if you took mind energy and made it a substance. You know, it's sort of that intermediate substance between the two direct substances of matter and spirit. You know, so you're engaging that threefold actuality in more and more literal ways. And so how much easier will it be to consecrate your mind to the universal harmony, to that triunity, when literally the triunity is in front of you? You can kick material bricks and Marantia bricks and spirit bricks. I mean, there's nothing abstract about it anymore. It's the triunity is literally right in front of you, and you can experience how those three play together in a harmony. So that's what they're stressing in both of those towards the end there. Let's see, maybe is there anything else there? Maybe just one little thing. That first paragraph about the reserves, picturing yourself doing what they were describing there, sitting down and, you know, and talking with them.
Yeah.
Think of some of the thrilling stories that some of these administrator seraphim can tell you about the day that Lucifer stepped forth and began to preach. how they wrestled with what he was saying and how enticing it was, and, you know, and they say, yeah, but no, and, you know, they'll be able to give you an eyewitness account of, you know, how, you know, someone not unlike you went through that process of not falling victim to the sophistry. Think about how helpful that will be for you to develop that integrity when you can actually talk to someone that, you know, experienced it much as you would have if you had been standing there, you know, and made it through the process. So that, you know, that'll be something that'll be really special for us and our system headquarters, you know, unlike, you know, systems where there wasn't a rebellion. All right. Why don't we just leave it right there? Thanks, everyone. Let's take a moment here.